Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Some prescription stimulants intended to treat attention deficit disorder have a history of misuse by people who are seeking a brain boost. The problem has been acute among young college students. A new study out of the University of California suggests that non-medical use of stimulants brings with it negatives. More negatives than positives. Sarah Mednick is a sleep expert and cognitive neuroscientist at the University of California, Irvine, and co-author of the UC study. She wrote about the issue for The Conversation. We'll post a link to that article at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome, Sarah Mednick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This problem's not new. What do we know about the prevalence of non-medical use of stimulants? And again, we're mostly talking about stimulants used to treat ADHD, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's two different issues here. One is that there's definitely a rise in the use of these drugs to treat people with ADHD. But then there's also a rise in the non-medical use of prescription stimulants. And that is one of the sort of the lesser known prescription stimulant issues, right? Non-medical use prescription problems. We focus so much on the opioid crisis. But we're not really focusing on these other drugs that are sort of, you know, not necessarily being looked at as being as dangerous because you don't have so many people winding up dead in the hospital from it. But at the same time, they're really disturbing a lot of sleep and cognitive processes.
Why are they being misused? You said that it's more hype than help. The hype come from that using Adderall is going to help you study better?
Well, if you think about why people use any kind of stimulant, it makes you feel speedy, right? It's basically amphetamine. It's similar to cocaine, right? People don't necessarily use cocaine because it makes them feel smarter, but they do feel really smart and they do feel really bold and they feel like they could conquer anything. You know, if you hear how people, you know, a great example is one of the subjects in the lab, an undergraduate, you know, when we asked him how he felt, and of course, this was a double-blind placebo-controlled study, so we didn't really know if he was on the drug, but once he got the drug, he said, "Oh my God, I feel amazing. I feel like I could ask anybody out." So there's this really strong confidence booster that happens that I think along with the feeling of speediness, you also feel very proud and very strong and like that you could conquer anything.
Is this more prevalent among younger people because they're more in contact with other people that might be prescribed the drugs or they talk about it among themselves? Do we know?
Yeah, that's exactly how it happens. The kids who are actually given these drugs because they have ADHD as children, they actually don't really like taking the drugs because it really changes their personality and you know, they can't sleep and they have all sorts of problems with taking the drugs. So when they get to college and they don't have their parents watching them, they start to give the drugs away, either by selling them or just by giving them away. And that's how these drugs actually get into the system a lot of the time. I mean, now you can actually, there's many people who sell them. You know, you can, there's a great article.
It's a commodity now. People want them. There's a demand for it.
Exactly, exactly. But it really just came through first with just kids just giving them away because they didn't want them.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Sarah Mednick about the issue of using prescription stimulants for non-medical reasons. It's been a particular problem with drugs used to treat attention deficit disorder, and it particularly affects young people. 1 in 10 people 18 to 24 have used them. In college, that number jumps to 2 in 10. Sarah Mednick has studied the problem. She is a sleep expert and cognitive neuroscientist at the University of California, Irvine. So it's not just a college kid problem. This is prevalent throughout, or, you know, is significant throughout that age group. But what are we learning about the health risks of using these stimulants for non-medical reasons? Are they endangering themselves?
Well, just like most stimulants, amphetamine, cocaine, any of these kind of stimulants, they trigger the dopaminergic system, dopamine, mm-hmm. which is really a very strong system for reward and addiction. So they are highly addictive. And what happens is also that they, you know, the biggest reason why people use them is that they stop you from needing to sleep, right? And so, of course, what happens there is that if you don't sleep, what we know from sleep is that sleep is incredibly important for your health and for your cognitive processes. And if you don't sleep, then you're going to have all sorts of secondary problems, such as not learning anything, right? So not only are you not getting the cognitive benefits while you're on the drug, because we've shown that actually the drugs don't make you particularly better at many different ranges of tasks, cognitive tasks, but also that has long-term negative effects on your sleep and reduces the most important parts of your sleep, which is this deep sleep.
You're a sleep expert. You study the role of sleep for brain functioning and health. So they keep us from sleeping. Do they disturb our sleep going forward?
Well, usually what they have, we've only looked at a 24-hour period. So mm-hmm. we give the drug in the morning, and then we test them on a bunch of cognitive tests that day, and then we have them sleep in the lab at night, and then we test them again when they wake up in the morning. So that's really just a 24-hour view. But you know, certainly it's, if you continue to take these drugs regularly, they're going to have the same long-term benefits as one night of sleep would have, you know, as they would have on one night of sleep. But then there's a lot of question about what are the long-term effects mm-hmm. of these drugs. And that's the part that we really don't know. There is some research that is being done at UC Irvine, actually, as well, looking at the long-term effects. But in general, we really don't know what the long-term effects of these drugs are. And that's also another reason why I think it's actually, you know, something that we really need to pay attention to.
And you were able to figure that even though I stayed up all night using Adderall and I studied my brains out and I thought I was doing great, you've shown, or there have been studies that show that there isn't a particular difference when it comes to test taking and that kind of a thing?
We didn't look at exactly test taking, but what we do in the laboratory is that we give them cognitive tasks for working memory and long-term memory, and we see and attention, which is really what it should be improving. Mm-hmm. And we try to see, you know, does the drug, when you're on the drug, improve any of these tasks? And then what about the long-term effects of these drugs in terms of, you know, your development of, you know, your formation of long-term memories? What we saw is when you're actually on the drug, there's a very small, only a 4% increase in attention. We saw no changes at all in working memory, which is a very important executive function for just keeping holding information in your mind while you're trying to work on it. And we saw actually extremely negative effects on long-term memory, which is that type of cognitive process that depends on sleep. It's a slow process where you form memories and you put them into long-term storage over a long period of time, including sleep. And when you decrease sleep due to amphetamines, you don't show that memory process.
I pulled plenty of all-nighters when I was in college, I'm ashamed to say. But I didn't use drugs.
Yeah, we all did.
But I didn't use drugs to achieve that. Still, I knew deep down that not getting the sleep, you know, was going to hurt me. But did you have a control group that also stayed up, or and compare and contrast them on that score?
We didn't. We compared them to people having placebo.
Okay.
But we didn't compare them to people who were sleep deprived. So that is actually a good suggestion. I think in general, you know, what we know already about sleep deprivation is that it has that same effect of alcohol, right? Where you drink alcohol and you think you're doing great and you think you're able to handle everything, but you're actually, you know, your performance is way worse than you think it is, right? So sleep deprivation shows exactly the same results, which is that you really don't know how much deterioration you've shown, and you seem as confident as if, you know, you've been asleep all night. So it really messes with your own sense of yourself and also with your performance.
The study was conducted across several campuses at the University of California. Did the results change from campus to campus?
And the results actually didn't change, but we only did the study at my old university, which is UC Riverside, and then I moved to UC Irvine and did the analysis there. So,
So
we actually only tested in one group, yeah.
And, you know, is there something that you can tell parents? I mean, a lot of college students don't have a parent that they're answering to, and I don't want to make that assumption, but what about, are there symptoms? Are there things that people can look for to see if maybe someone is abusing these kinds of stimulants?
Well, I think that it's something that the universities really need to take, you know, take control of right now, or really take an interest in. I think that, yes, parents, obviously, but if the kids are not around and they're doing this stuff, you know, during college days, then it's really, I think, the university needs to start getting into more of the awareness work. You know, if you're talking to somebody who isn't really sleeping and who seems pretty speedy, and a lot of people would just admit to taking these drugs. It's not like it's a secret. You know, people are talking about this in classrooms. I often ask my students, you know, what's the prevalence? And a lot of them will raise their hands. So it's not like it's a weird phenomenon now where people don't think that this is wrong, right? They don't think it's bad. Which might actually be fine because then it's good for, you know, education and we can talk about it and get it out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have the kind of illicit quality that taking an opioid would, right?
Mm.
So I think that there's a lot of discussion about, is this really worth it? You know, but at the same time, people are also using it to party. So it's not just for studying, right?
Yeah.
So half of the kids who use it are saying that they use it to, you know, increase their length of being able to drink, right? So, and that is where they also really end up in the emergency room because the poly substance use can have extremely dangerous outcomes. So, you know, I think that there's two different approaches that need to be attacked. One is really just dealing with, like, this is really not necessarily helping you study. What's going to help you is just sleeping and studying and sleeping and studying and doing, you know, what people have done throughout education history. But then the other issue is, you know, really watching how people are partying and letting people know, educating them on the dangers of mixing all these different substances.
I'm going to take a quick call right now. Jeremy in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Yeah, I've got a question for your guest. When you were doing the studies, what was the exact dosages that you were using, and was it the instant release versus the extended release? And do you find that the actual dosage obviously makes a big difference? But if someone was taking a very small dose versus a much larger dose, like the 25 milligram extended release, is there a difference there?
Yeah, Sarah Mendick.
We use 20 milligrams of dextroamphetamine. And definitely there's a huge effect of dosage, and especially if you do it for, you know, if you look at, you know, the dose per kilogram, then it would be even more specific. So we just use one dosage because usually that's how people, they just grab what they can get and they can, and that's a standard dosage that people use. But I think that definitely, you know, smaller amounts are going to probably have some difference in terms of their effect on sleep and their effect on cognition. But I guess the problem is, you know, are people able to really know how good they are on these drugs? Like, how, you know, are people doing their own experiments to say, if I don't use these drugs at all, how do I do, right? If I just sleep, if I just study, versus if I use these drugs, what is, you know, that's my question in terms of really getting an insight into whether these drugs are helping.
Sarah Mendick, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sarah Mendick. She's a sleep expert and cognitive neuroscientist at the University of California, Irvine. We've been talking about the misuse of prescription amphetamines. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at WOSU.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new study published in the National Academy of Sciences peer-reviewed journal says that prenatal stress in pregnant women may affect the sex of the baby and lead to some birth complications. Marcy Lobel is a professor of social and health psychology and the director of the Stress and Reproduction Lab at Stony Brook University. Her research focuses primarily on prenatal maternal stress and its impact on birth outcomes. Welcome, Marcy Lobel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What did you make of the study that I just mentioned that found that prenatal stress in pregnant women may affect the sex of the baby and lead to birth complications? First of all, what about gender? What in the world would that have to do with gender?
Well, first of all, I should acknowledge that I have not read that article yet. It's new to me. I believe it was written by collaborators or colleagues of mine. But there is a longstanding history that suggests that male fetuses are particularly vulnerable not only to psychosocial stressors during pregnancy, but also to environmental toxins. So as I said, I haven't read the article, but I would hypothesize that it selects for which gender. You want to tell me the answer?
Men? Male?
Okay. Well, you know, a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that more male infants are born than female infants. So their vulnerability continues not only during the prenatal period, but also in the first year of life. And that's how we end up with a practically even gender ratio. But it wouldn't surprise me to see that the male fetuses are actually more vulnerable to those stressors.
So the point is that when a woman is experiencing stress, it manifests as well in some way with the fetus.
Oh, yes. You know, that's a topic that we've been studying for more than 30 years in my laboratory, and others have been investigating it as well. So it's a very robust finding in the scientific literature. And I think it's important to be clear about the type of stress that is harmful for pregnant women. We're not talking about, you know, acute daily stressors that are just normal in everyday living. I think we should all acknowledge that stress is just a normal part of being human, particularly in modern society, as it was actually in prehistoric times as well. And those stressors, of course, were quite different because we're not worried about tigers or other things on the savanna. But we are exposed to a lot of stressors in our work life and in our interpersonal relationships. The kind of stress that appears to be most harmful in pregnancy is chronic stress at high levels. And in addition, what I would caution people to think about is that it's not necessarily the stress itself that causes these effects, but how people respond to stress. And so we know that there are biological responses to high chronic stress, as well as behavioral responses. We know that some responses are healthier than others. So I always caution people when they talk about this not to alarm pregnant women, because many of us, myself included, during our pregnancies, continue to work and uphold lots of responsibilities that can impose daily stresses on us.
Well, I decided to move an entire household 1 month before I gave birth, which I think was one of the stupidest things I've ever done. But I want to get to when you say chronic stress at high levels, is that what we think of as toxic stress?
Well, you could label it that way. You certainly could. And again, the question is not whether people are doing things like moving their households, which, you know, as you point out, might not have been the best thing to do in the latter part of pregnancy. Doesn't sound like a fun thing to do at any point right. in one's life. But nevertheless, whether it affected the way that you take care of yourself when you experience such disruptions in life, whether, for example, in our research, we've shown that women who experience this kind of stress are more likely to resort to dangerous substances like alcohol and cigarettes, as well as not doing things like following their prenatal care regimen, not taking their prenatal vitamins, not getting enough sleep, not eating a healthy diet, not getting physical activity. And I want to mention that because I think there are a lot of misconceptions about physical activity as well, and our research has documented that as well. As long as it's not contraindicated by a healthcare provider, pregnant women should be having some moderate physical activity. Until it becomes uncomfortable or difficult for them.
We have talked about complications in birth and the prevalence among African-American women and the toxicity of stress that they experience. And we know that it crosses socioeconomic barriers. Yeah. What do you know about that?
Well, first of all, I just on the last thing that you said, very interestingly, the disparity in adverse birth outcomes between women of color, particularly African-American women, and white or European-American women actually increases at higher socioeconomic levels.
That's interesting.
So what that tells us is that it's not due to a lack of economic resources. What it appears to be due to is greater exposure to discrimination. One of the areas of study in my lab over the last 15 years or so is identifying what we call gendered racism or gendered racism in pregnancy, because to be black, female, and pregnant in America is a triple threat. And we've shown that women are exposed to unique forms of discrimination if they are black and pregnant. And that women are aware of those forms of discrimination and that they contribute to emotional distress in those women. And all of this, I would say, is apart from the possibility that those women also experience different types or qualities of healthcare, even in very well-resourced communities.
Because of their race.
Yes, because, well, of the unique, what we call intersectional identity of those women, because they are not only women, but they are women of color, and they are pregnant women of color. And we've even shown experimentally that people respond to a pregnant black woman differently than they respond to every other combination, non-pregnant black woman, pregnant non-black woman, etc. So there is something unique happening there in their experience. In life in America.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Marcy Lobel. She's a professor of social and health psychology and the director of the Stress and Reproduction Lab at Stony Brook University. We're talking about stress and pregnancy and just talking about stress and pregnancy in women of color. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about managing anxiety or depression when you're pregnant? And what about the medications that are typically used to address anxiety and depression? Some women go off the medications because they're worried it's going to harm the fetus.
Yes. Well, you know, I want to be very clear. I am not a physician, and I would encourage all pregnant women to seek proper health care from a licensed and well-qualified professional. I do know the literature suggests that in some cases it is more harmful to go off one's medication than to stay on the medications. Unfortunately, we don't know as much as we should know about the impact of some anti-anxiety medications and antidepressants during pregnancy. And I think that that also illustrates the lack of proper attention to women's health that has existed for many decades. And, you know, we do clearly need to know more about that. We need large studies, and we need to look at them quite carefully. I do want to add also that we've had a lot of public conversation about postpartum depression and mm-hmm. other mood disorders.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of people don't realize is that those disorders are no more common after the birth of a child than they are at any other time in a woman's life, which isn't to say that postpartum depression or anxiety shouldn't receive attention and treatment. It certainly should. But we should also be devoting the same level of attention to women during pregnancy and prior to pregnancy and elderly women and all groups of women who are exposed to these illnesses. You know, just as a comparison, a country like Denmark, which, by the way, has a system of universal access to health care, subsidies for the cost of child care, and paid maternal leave, has a postpartum depression rate that is close to zero. It's less than 1%. What does that tell you? You know, those women are not biologically different than women in the United States. What's different is the resources that they're provided with and the support that they're provided with.
Right. I mean, the study suggested, the study we were talking about earlier, that a crucial factor in reducing stress in pregnant women is maintaining a strong social support system. And in that case, in Denmark, it's wraparound.
Yes, absolutely. It starts from the top and goes all the way down. So support should come from our institutions as well as from our loved ones, from our workplaces. You know, if we want to have healthy moms and babies, then we need to commit the resources and the attention to make that possible.
You've mentioned that many moms also neglect their own health after a baby's birth. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of funny that I'm not sure OBGYNs address much of that when you're doing your follow-ups.
Right, right. Yes, yes. I think that that's unfortunate. And that actually may be one reason why we're able to pick up more of these anxiety and mood and depression disorders in women during pregnancy, because women are getting regular health care then. So prenatal care provides a window of opportunity for all kinds of identification and screening. Another area that's emerging from our lab, another area of research, is we're studying substance use and particularly opioid use disorder in pregnancy. And sometimes this goes undetected, but when a woman appears for prenatal care, that's an opportune time to engage in the screening process and provide her with any kind of intervention and referral that she might need.
You're saying drug testing?
No, I'm not saying drug testing.
Okay.
I'm saying, you know, talking to women
gotcha.
About their life experience, what problems they may be having, including addiction, but any other kinds of acute forms of stress that those women are experiencing.
What about physical and mental abuse?
That's also a window of opportunity and yet another area that we've been looking at. So there really weren't any good data until recently looking at whether violence, interpersonal violence, what sometimes is called intimate partner violence, whether that decreases in pregnancy. There's very mixed evidence about that in women who've already been targets. I don't like to use the word victims, but targets of violence prior mm-hmm. to pregnancy. So that's another important area of study. And as I say, pregnancy is another opportune time to identify women who need help.
And as far as just, you know, a lot of people can relate to this when you have a kid and then they go into daycare and then you start catching everything they're catching.
Oh, yes.
I can just remember I can't even imagine living through again what I did then and what I put up with as far as catching everything and constantly being sick.
Yes.
But
yes.
not and, calling and... into work because
right.
I couldn't.
Yes. Well, this is why we need to have those kinds of supports in our workplace. You know, I mentioned earlier the importance of institutional support. And I should also say, I am also the mother of two children, so I don't merely study these topics. They've also affected me quite personally. And I recall seeing a study years ago that suggested that parents of small children get 8 colds a year.
Yeah.
Now, I can't vouch for that. I don't recall where I read that study or how valid it was. It felt like even more than 8 colds a year, didn't it?
Well, it felt like one constant cold.
Yes.
And
yes.
Sinus infection and whatnot.
Yes.
That you just lived with.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I completely acknowledge and value the fact that I've been in a privileged professional position where if I'm ill, for the most part, unless I have to teach on a particular day, I can just not go into my office. But we realize that there are many women who can't do that, who are working on factory lines, who are working in sales positions, in secretarial positions, you know, what we call the pink labor force, who simply don't have those options. And that is disturbing. I actually was just discussing with my students the other day when we talked about pay inequities in women in one of my large undergraduate courses. If a child is sick and two people are working, there are two parents working, male and female presumably, but not always,
mm-hmm.
Who's the one that's going to stay home with the child? The one who earns less money, correct? So the impact of sick children disproportionately falls on moms. Because women tend to earn less than their partners and tend to be in the kind of positions where, where missing those days of work is not going to have as great an impact on their professional success.
But they do also tend to be in more unstable jobs and would be losing, you know, it would affect
right.
their
yes.
job status more
yes.
than, say, someone in the higher paying, higher status job.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And let me just add to that is actually one explanation for the pay differential that exists in our society, the gender gap in pay. It's called the motherhood penalty, you know, that women are more likely to be the ones taking off days of work, and not just days, maybe taking a maternity leave, which could be unpaid and which could disrupt their professional trajectory.
Lots to unpack there. Marcy Lobel, I appreciate your time in doing it today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marcy Lobel is a professor of social and health psychology and the director of the Stress and Reproduction Lab at Stony Brook University. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new report in Healthy Babies Bright Futures says that 95% of baby food contains toxic heavy metals. We're talking about what that means, how it affects what and how we feed infants. Melanie Potok is a pediatric speech language pathologist and feeding specialist in Colorado. She's the author of several books on nutritional health in children, including the 2015 book Raising a Healthy, Happy Eater, A Parent's Handbook, a stage-by-stage guide to setting your child on the path to adventurous eating. Welcome, Melanie.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is one of my favorite topics, kids and food.
What did you make of the study that says 95% of baby food contains toxic heavy metals?
Well, it's naturally, you first read that and it sends off alarm bells. But what it really came down to for me is when I looked at which foods they were talking about that had the highest risk, snacky foods that are mostly made out of rice flour, teethers, cereal, mostly infant rice cereal, fruit juice, and of course, baby carrots, which is the most popular first vegetable for children. All of those are all just fine foods. It's just that we don't want to get stuck on them. We don't want to overfeed them. So I think we have to be careful not to become too alarmed over this yet. Take it seriously and find some good solutions.
Why are there toxic heavy metals in baby food?
Well, you know, keep in mind that I'm a pediatric feeding specialist and
right.
not a scientist in that area. But according to the study, it sounds like it has mostly to do with, especially the rice, the fact that it's grown in water and the water has many of these chemicals in it, and it's quickly absorbed. And interestingly enough, I would have thought that brown rice, which we think of as healthier, would be the smarter solution.
Uh-huh.
But actually, that's not the case, because white rice has that outer hull removed, and so some of the chemicals are actually removed in that process as well.
And what about infants with developing brains? Do they do their brains and their bodies respond to these kinds of things differently than a full-grown, you know, adult?
Well, I think that's really the big question. And the study seems to indicate that, yes, that's the case. But when we get down to just common sense, it's because we have smaller bodies as an infant, and mm-hmm. we are developing at an incredibly rapid rate, especially when it comes to brain growth. So we want to make sure that those babies have the healthiest possible nutrition we can offer.
What foods, all things being equal, that is, you know, taking into consideration allergies and other things,
sure.
What foods should we incorporate in an infant diet?
Well, what it really comes down to, Anne, is variety. It's one meal for one family. So with all the families that I'm working with who are trying to raise these healthy, happy eaters, what we're trying to do is not get stuck on little mini puffs, you know, the little cans of beginner foods, the little puff stars that everyone tends to buy. We call those learning foods in my profession. And I always recommend to my families, hey, if you'd like to buy those, buy one container and that's it. It's a learning food for learning how to chew. But there are plenty of other foods that we're eating as a family that will help kids learn to chew as well. We can almost take any food that we're eating and pulverize it into one of those little mini blenders that we all use for on-the-go smoothies nowadays and incorporate a lot of good nutrition, a lot of good flavor, which is so important to develop their palate, and not worry so much about the fact that we want to totally avoid, say, rice cereal or some of these other foods like fruit juice. Just consider those as occasional foods. Don't get stuck on them. That's the issue.
And then, so you're saying just, what about staying away from stuff? I'm going to just guess you're going to say highly processed foods.
Right, right. And I want to be a realist, though, because the snack aisle exists. But for the most part, I think sometimes when things have the word snack on the package, mm-hmm. they aren't the healthiest option. That's not always true. But in general, we really want to try to offer variety and stay out of the snack aisle and only have that on occasion. And one of the biggest things that I talk to my families about is juice. Because I certainly was raised with my children who are now in their 30s that juice was a healthy thing to offer children. But we now know that that's not the case. And the American Academy of Pediatrics really recommends that kids have water, milk, formula, breast milk, et cetera, rather than 100% fruit juice. But if we are going to offer juice, it's a treat. Think of it like a treat.
Like, so the juice boxes, I mean, they're ubiquitous now.
Oh, well, yeah.
Or the pouches or whatever they use now.
Yes, definitely, as are the pouches. And when we think about that, many of those pouches have up to 3 whole apples pulverized into them. You would never hand your toddler 3 apples to eat, but they can suck down one of those pouches in one quick, well, swoop.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we do want to just think about keeping up with variety, that certain foods should be very occasional foods, that don't be scared if rice shows up on the plate at the restaurant. But on the other hand, let's make sure that we're not offering an overabundance of rice products.
What do we know about children, young children, and why they won't eat certain foods? I mean, everybody knows someone who had a kid who all they ate was macaroni and cheese for 5 or 6 years, sometimes a lot longer, sadly.
Well, Anne, that is my life.
I'm sure those are your people, right?
Yes, those are my people. That's absolutely right. As a pediatric feeding specialist, what I do is I work with children who get stuck in that chicken nugget rut.
Mm.
And whether they have a medical reason for it, perhaps a severe allergy has really limited what they can eat. Perhaps they have autism or sensory processing disorder. Or perhaps they're just that typical picky eater who never really grows out of it. And do you know what, Anne? 1 out of 4 typical picky eaters do not grow out of it and require treatment in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways to just tie it back into what we're talking about today that they get stuck is that parents, well-meaning parents, want to give them something that they know they'll eat. You know, just give them a juice box and some of those, that rice cereal. He'll eat that.
Mm-hmm.
They want to feed their kid. They're worried about their kid.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening is when we continue to offer the exact same foods over and over, not only are we reinforcing the child's behavior, but we're also beginning to morph their desire for other foods. If you only eat the same foods, you quickly learn not to desire other foods. It doesn't take too long at all, especially in the humans, and the little humans is what I meant. But
mm-hmm.
It's easy. It always comes down to variety. So even if we just put a tablespoon of whatever the rest of the family is eating on their plate, that's where we start. We don't expect them to eat it. We're starting with just the sight of it, the smell of it, the pleasure of cooking it together, that type of exposure.
Preparation is key. And one report says that report we were talking about, that carrots and sweet potatoes are on the list of foods that are most contaminated. But by using cycling out or spicing up the veggies, a parent can reduce the baby's risk by 73%. I mean, what does that involve?
Well, I think really the best resource for that is I think it's like a 40-page article and the report that was recently released, because they have a lot of different ideas there. But one thing that they do mention, and this applies to rice as well, is that when we are preparing these foods, if we're preparing them in water, as rice is, of course, to actually use more water to cook the rice and then strain it off, and that will help to dilute that content that we're worried about. With carrots and sweet potatoes, my understanding is they weren't quite as specific around that,
mm-hmm.
but we can also consider that, as you just mentioned, we can mix carrots and sweet potatoes into other vegetables, and we can still get the nutrition and the benefit from those really wonderful root vegetables, but we can mix them in with a few other things so that we are decreasing the heavy metal level.
What do we know about how the color of the food is, how infants respond to that?
In terms of the sight, do you mean? Or
yeah, what it looks like.
Yeah.
Do they? Is that a thing?
Well, that's such a good question. We know for sure that we first feast with our eyes, that our visual sense is the first thing that children tune into, and the next one is touch. So naturally, if they are thinking about reaching out and picking up something off the table, off their plate, off the high chair tray, we want it to be visually appealing. What's hard to tease out is it actually the color, or could it be the shape, or could it be that it's easier to pick up?
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is to be thinking about all that when you're offering food to your children, because again, we feast with our eyes, and if it's bland and sort of boring looking, they're not going to be as interested.
So instead of all of the crackery things that are spiced and colored like orange and yellow, if we could just do a few more of those in green, it might make that less of an issue going forward. What about proteins, meats, fish, chicken?
In terms of things to be offering babies specifically?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of families are surprised that one of the best foods, first foods for babies is actually salmon. As long as there's no history of a shellfish or some type of fish allergy,
mm-hmm.
we always want to check with the pediatrician. Things like salmon, it's so soft and almost has a buttery, oily texture. It's very easy for babies to learn to chew and swallow. Be sure to pull out any bones, of course.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great source of protein. And another wonderful source are peas. Peas are a great source, as are, just popped into my head and popped right out. Oh, peanut butter.
Mm.
But, you know, for years, we got away from feeding young children peanut butter because we thought it contributed to allergies. But as research does, it turned the tables on us. And now we know, as long as there isn't a history of allergies, again, check with your pediatrician to see what they'd like you to do,
mm-hmm.
then we really want these kids to have a little bit of peanut butter. But we don't want them to have a spoonful, because it's the spoonful or the glob on the spoon that can be really chokeable for babies.
Hmm.
But you want to always spread it thinly.
I and use that cracker. Let's see. John in Columbus, you're on the air with Melanie Potok, pediatric speech-language pathologist and feeding specialist. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. Sorry, there's a truck alongside me if it's noisy. But, you know, this is a subject that's very near and dear to my heart because I have nieces and nephews who are in college and still won't eat anything except macaroni and cheese or peanut butter and jelly. And I have a somewhat unusual family. I have two daughters in their late 20s and an 8-year-old son. And this may sound overly simplistic, and it, for some families it probably is. But my kids weren't allowed to not eat what we were eating, you know. And in my experience, just looking at friends and family, you know, if you give in to a small child's demands, I don't want this, I don't like it, before they've even tasted it, and then rush off to the box of Kraft macaroni and cheese, you're just really enabling that. My kids weren't allowed to do that. They had to eat what we prepared, and I love to cook, and we eat clean, and we eat healthy. And to this very day, all three of them will eat everything. And I just think that's cool.
Well, you know, we did with our kid. We had an only child, so you know, it's a real easy to fall into spoiling them. But we just never made special dinners. Sometimes I ate macaroni and cheese with them, but that was always part of the dinner. What about John's strategy, Melanie? What do you make of that? Because I was also one of those kids that was sitting at the dinner table for 3 extra hours while my dad waited for me to have that one bite of spinach. Which I now love.
Yeah, that's great that you now love it. John, first of all, I really appreciate your point that this may not apply to all children. And I appreciate the fact that you're being sensitive, that there are definitely kids out there who have been born prematurely or perhaps have a medical need or other issues that naturally are going to get in the way of feeding development. Because the main thing to remember is feeding is developmental, just like learning to crawl, walk, run. And if a child was having difficulty crawling, we wouldn't expect him to just get up and run. And I know that's not what you're saying, but just to clarify that, I appreciate your point. I 100% agree that for typically developing children, we want to be really careful that we don't become short order cooks.
Yeah.
That we continue to present a variety of foods. And here's the misstep that many parents make. And John, I have a feeling you didn't do this. Many parents think that because they've offered it, on average, we know for sure it's 3 to 5 times, which the research shows. I've given it to him 3 or 5 times and he didn't like it. So I'm not going to offer it again. I mean, it's a waste of food, which I understand. But the research also shows that it can take up to 15 exposures, not taste, but just exposures, as John mentioned, just cooking together in the kitchen, in order to enhance the acceptance of the food. So I have a feeling, Anne, what actually happened with you with spinach is that maybe you had to eat it, but you probably had more positive experiences around spinach. Perhaps it was through cooking or gardening or shopping together that eventually developed that veggie love. And that's what we're really trying to get to.
John, thanks a lot for that call. I'll tell you, I feel like it was going to college and just realizing what I missed and then eating it constantly because there was so much crap in the college dormitory food that I started to love vegetables because that was the only fresh thing that seemed to appear. And it was a gradual thing, though. But Melanie Potok, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
It was wonderful to chat with you. Thanks for having me on today, Anne.
You bet. Melanie Potok, pediatric speech-language pathologist, a feeding specialist, and author of several books, including Raising a Healthy, Happy Eater. Thanks for listening. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.